Okay, so that concludes our presentations related to water. Although everything we will talk about in the next day or two will certainly involve water. And so that takes us up to the topic on vegetation and wetlands. And that will be presented by Chris Roble. Chris is a wetland ecologist with HDR Alaska. He is a self-described botany geek and Alaska wilderness explorer to the core. He first came to Alaska to work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 1999, where he lived for 3.5 months in a field camp in the uninhabited barren islands between Homer and Kodiak. That experience cemented a desire for permanent residency in 2000. He's been with HDR since 2006 and joined the Pebble Project team in 2007. He is HDR's current project manager for the Vegetation and Wetland Studies. He and Ann Leggett essentially co-lead HDR's team, with Ann as acting as HDR's senior technical advisor. For any fellow botanical, how do you say that? Botanical? Okay, thank you. Botanical people in the room, Chris's favorite genera include the sedges, carex, and the willows, salix. So let's give Chris our attention here as he presents wetlands and vegetation.
Good afternoon. All right, so as Jane mentioned, I'll be presenting HDR's portion of the vegetation and wetland studies. I should point out a few things first. HDR's studies were focused on the transportation corridor. The presentation after mine will be given by Three Parameters Plus, their fieldwork, and EBD focused on the mine study area. Looks like I waited too long to touch the mouse. There we go. First off, I'd like to give my thanks to a few individuals and organizations. I'd like to give special thanks to the landowners along the transportation corridor. The corridor crossed a series of properties that were owned by regional native organizations, and they allowed us to access sites and collect our field data, and we were often accompanied by observers who were members of these corporations. I'd like to thank the staff at the Pebble Limited Partnership for allowing us to do objective work and supporting us in that. I'd especially like to thank Cheryl Moody and her team at Three Parameters for providing technical leadership. With just a few subtle differences, for the most part, the methods for HDR are largely the same as Three Parameter Plus's methods. I'd also like to thank Resource Data for building the wetlands database and maintaining it, the individual staff out in Iliamna for allowing us to do safe and comfortable work, and of course our team at HDR for their dedication and professionalism. So just a quick overview on our study. I'll talk about the purpose of the two studies, the wetlands and vegetation studies, the study areas, the scope of the two studies. For the methods, I thought I would just summarize the methods. I think these have been presented quite extensively in past agency meetings, and I'm sure if there are any gaps in my presentation, Steve and Kai will help fill those. And then we'll get into the results at the end. I'll wait just a second here while the mouse is remembering its job. There we go. So the purpose of the vegetation study, to develop vegetation data to support the wetland study, and to support the wildlife habitat study. The vegetation mapping was provided to ABR for use to map habitat types. The purpose of the wetland study was to delineate wetlands in accordance with standard U.S. Army Corps of Engineer protocol. This slide gives a summary of the EBD chapters. I wanted to just point this out because the studies are presented in four different chapters. They're organized based on the drainage. So we have wetlands and vegetation studies that are summarized based on the Bristol Bay drainage and again within the Cook Inlet drainage. For the Bristol Bay chapters, the chapters are split for the mine study area and the transportation corridor. This slide shows the study areas. I'll highlight those. Here's the general deposit location. This purple polygon, this shows the outline of the mine study area. And so 3PPI, they will be discussing the results from within this area later. And then the transportation corridor begins at the boundary of the mine study area and extends to the east to Cook Inlet. And I should mention that the polygon that's shown for the transportation corridor, this is termed the study area. So what we mean by that is this is the area in which field data was collected. The results that were derived from the mapping came from an area within the study area, and that's termed the mapping area. The mapping area is approximately a corridor that's 2,000 feet wide. And it does not include, the mapping area may not always include the full extent of the area that was covered by field teams. So the scope of our vegetation study, and the intent was to characterize every distinct vegetation community that occurred and to characterize them in all the landscape positions where they occurred throughout the project area. We described all of those vegetation types by their species composition and the abundance of species within each type. We mapped all of the vegetation types in GIS, and we also collected incidental observations on any rare plants. I can add that there are no threatened or endangered plant species in the project area. So by rare plants, these are plants that are tracked by the Alaska Natural Heritage Program. In comparison, the wetland study, the intent was to locate wetlands and water bodies and to document the decision-making process in the field that allowed us to make those wetland determinations. And also we mapped all wetlands and water bodies within GIS. Here's a detailed shot of the transportation corridor study area. And I'll just point out a few landmarks. So the mine study area begins on the left-hand side of the screen. Here's the New Halen River, Roadhouse Mountain, Canyon Creek, Knutson Mountain, Pyle Bay. And this is the drainage divide between Bristol Bay and Cook Inlet, Williamsport, and Nisqually Bay. So prior to going out into the field, some of the information that we had at our fingertips include high resolution, true color, ortho-rectified aerial imagery. The imagery was captured at a resolution of about 1 to 8,000, and it was rectified 1.5 foot pixels. Topographic data was 4-foot contours. We also brought in any available National Wetlands Inventory mapping. Mappers in the office before going out into the field, and in most areas they pre-map the area using manual air photo interpretation techniques, and they outlined distinct vegetation types, assigned preliminary vegetation codes, and also interpreted wetland status through air photo interpretation. The vegetation classification system that we used was unique to the project, but I say that with that's not quite true. It was largely based on the Alaska vegetation classification system. This is commonly referred to the VEREC system, and we identified vegetation types to level 4 of this system. So essentially what we did is we took VEREC codes, level 4 codes, and we evaluated if those communities could be reliably photo interpreted in our mapping, and then in some cases we aggregated codes or we split communities, all for the purpose to support accurate photo interpretation. For wetland classification, we first classified wetlands simply if it was wetland, a non-wetland, or a complex mosaic of the two, or if it was a water body, and later we attributed all wetlands with NWI codes. The primary objectives of the vegetation study, first we wanted to relate site vegetation to its aerial photography image. Again, this was getting at the intent that the project area would be manually photo interpreted. And we wanted to determine whether vegetation at each site met the criteria to be wetland vegetation. And so with that, what we're trying to get at is, for each distinct vegetation type, can you reliably say that this type, it always exists as in a wetland environment on the landscape, or no, it only exists in an upland environment, or it can go either way. Here's an example of the photo interpretation process. So this yellow polygon that's shown in the upper right, this is an area that's just been pulled out because of a distinct photo signature, using clues such as, you know, the average tree height, the spacing between the trees to give a relative value of cover, the texture, to try to help identify what the plant types are there. This red dot is an example of a field point. And the photo in the lower left corner, this is an actual photo from the site just to compare, you know, what it looked like on the ground. And so a large part of the vegetation mapping was going between these two, taking field observations and developing photo signature patterns that we could use to reliably extrapolate what we were seeing on the ground with those vegetation types in the mapping. So what kind of vegetation data did we collect at each plot? And plots were typically a tenth of an acre radius and size. That's a standard plot size for wetland delineations. We made an effort to identify every plant species that was present within the plot. We estimated the percent cover, so looking downward, how much foliage was present for that species in the plot. We used ocular estimates to estimate cover. We assigned each species to a strata. And the strata criteria, again, were based on Army Corps of Engineer definition. So we used tree strata, saplings and shrubs, and herbaceous strata. Each plot that was sampled was assigned a project vegetation type using the classification system I mentioned earlier. If any plants were observed that we could not identify in the field, we made our best faith effort to collect those plants and either identify them at the end of the day or bring them back to our lab in town and key those out. And for rare plants that were observed, we collected rare plants when we could determine in the field that a collection would not harm that population. So we did collect voucher specimens for all the rare plants that we found. It's probably helpful just to point out that the field work began in 2004 and continued in 2005. This was a time of a lot of dynamic change in the project, and the methods were changing and evolving quite a bit. And we found that the Alaska vegetation classification system that we were using, the VIREC system, wasn't perfectly adequate for air photo interpretation. So we either added new vegetation types if our field data supported unique vegetation types, or in some cases we combined some of the VIREC types. And a good example of combinations would be the wet sedge communities. There were a number of sedge types that in the ground they're easy to distinguish, but when you look at them through true color imagery, they all basically look the same and they can't be pulled apart. But they all share the same wetland status. So we did add new vegetation types, or in some instances we split vegetation types. All of the project vegetation types were documented and compiled in 3PPI's vegetation photo signature guide. And this was a desk reference that all the mappers had, and it had representative photos from the air photography, ground photos, and a plant species list. And so this document allowed mappers to consistently attribute polygons across both consultants and within the consulting teams. For wetlands, shifting gears a little bit, the objectives were, of course, to determine wetland and upland status for each site, and again, to determine the vegetation's association with wet conditions or dry conditions, and also to locate water bodies. So what is a wetland? For this project, we used the Corps of Engineers and the EPA's standard definition. I won't read this, but one key difference between wetlands and water bodies is that wetlands are defined as areas that support plants that thrive in saturated soil conditions. Water bodies are also wet, but typically they lack vegetation. As I mentioned, the wetland study relied upon the Corps of Engineers methods. For the transportation corridor, we followed the 1987 delineation manual exclusively. And again, that's because the data were collected from 2004 to 2005. I'll go through just a quick summary of how the wetland definition works in practice. So in the field, a wetland had to have three criteria. They had to have hydrophytic vegetation, hydric soils, and wetland hydrology. For wetland vegetation, to determine if it was indeed wetland vegetation, this is a simplification of our process. First, for every species that we identified, we gave that species a standard code, and the code was basically, was the plant almost always found in a wetland on one extreme, and the opposite extreme code was, is this a plant that thrives in upland environments? So that's the range, and within that range, we would give each species a code. Then we applied a standard calculation using the cover values for each plant to determine which plants were dominant at the site. And then together, those two variables, a plant's tendency to grow in a wetland environment and its dominance, we were able to calculate if the dominant plants are wet-tolerant vegetation. And if they are, then that parameter for wetland vegetation was met. For assessing the soil conditions, at each plot we excavated a soil pit. The pits were typically 2 feet deep. And we looked at the soil, and the intent was to collect observations that would support whether or not the soil was in a reduced environment or an oxidized environment. And here the important part is evidence of long-term depletion of oxygen indicates hydric soils. So the third parameter is wetland hydrology, and that can be identified from saturation or evidence of inundation. Examples of this are water seeping into the pit, high surface water, watermarks. Watermarks can be lines or rings on the stems of trees or shrubs that indicate that the area has been flooded for a period in the growing season, or debris deposits. On our field forms, in addition to data to support the three-parameter assessment, we also for each plot, we recorded the landform, the slope aspect, and topography. We also assigned a hydrogeomorphic type code, or HGM. HGM codes are often used in functional assessments for wetlands, and they are, HGM is essentially a combination of the shape of the landscape that contains the wetland, the source of precipitation, and how water moves through a site. And at each plot in the field, we also assigned a national wetland inventory code. So I wanted to add a photo of our field maps to help kind of give you a better understanding of a typical day. So field plots are shown with a four number system, like 1738, and field teams would walk basically from one helicopter landing zone to another landing zone, and these were a little bit difficult to find along the transportation corridor because it's so heavily forested. So in between those logical drop-off and pickup points, they would visit every distinct vegetation type in between the two endpoints, and collect detailed vegetation and wetland data to assign the necessary attributes. So after the field data was collected, all of the field data was uploaded to a relational database. This is maintained by RDI. The data were QC'd at three levels. The first level of QC is really, it's the type of QC you do at the end of a field day, checking for blanks and obvious errors. A second level of QC would be to ensure accuracy into the database. And the third level of QC was a comprehensive cross-checking between different plots or related codes within plots or related codes across multiple plots for consistency. Once the data were fully QC'd, select data were pulled out of the database and populated into the GIS as point-specific spatial data. So within GIS, we had a point file that had the wetland status, the vegetation code, the HGM code, and so on. And so that field point-specific data could be directly correlated with the mapping units in GIS. In this slide, here's an example of a final map from the EBD. To produce the final mapping, all of the pre-mapping line work and coding was adjusted based on the results of the field work. In some cases, additional coding was added where it was needed, such as hydrogeomorphic codes and national wetland inventory codes. Any areas that had human disturbance were also given a disturbance code. To QC this mapping, here's just a few examples of the process that we went to. We compared all the point data that had been QC'd with the polygon coding for conflicts, and then we compared contradictions between related codes. So vegetation types that may not occur in wetlands, we checked those codes to make sure that there were that those vegetation types did not have any wetland attributes assigned to them. In this slide, this is actually a good example for some clarification in the EBD. So earlier I talked about the study area and the mapping area. The study area can be seen in this orange line, And then the mapping area is this corridor that's bounded by the red lines. So there are field plots that were collected between the orange and the red line, but it's just this 2,000-foot wide corridor that was used to produce most of the results in the EBD. So getting on to the results then, we collected 736 full vegetation plots. By full, we mean that an attempt was made to identify every species and to assign composition and abundance values. We collected an additional 665 wetland determinations. Limited data, this could be streamlined sites where photographs and maybe basic wetland information was collected. Limited data sites accounted for 617 plots. And within the transportation corridor, this all rolls up to 49 distinct vegetation types. From these 49 types within the EBD, there's we present data for all 49 types, and then we aggregate it a few ways to help the reader to make it a bit more simple to digest. The 49 vegetation types are grouped into general types, and I believe there are about 9 general types, and then those general types are grouped even further into ecological regions across the corridor. So I will be, for the results, I'll present largely a higher scale than the detailed 49 types. So this map shows the transportation corridor. Across the corridor, there's quite a bit of variation from the mine study area to Cook Inlet. And, you know, what we see with the vegetation in general is that closer to the mine area, from the mine study area to Canyon Creek, which is here, the vegetation is largely dominated by white spruce woodlands. And then from Canyon Creek to Shinkley's Creek, which is about here, the vegetation transitions to a mixed spruce birch forest. And then from Shinkley's Creek to the coast, we see a third transition to a mountainous shrubland that's largely dominated by alder thickets. So let's take a look at each of those three types. This photo, I believe, was taken between Roadhouse and Knutson Mountains. It's looking to the north. So in the foreground, this is a very typical woodland, white spruce woodland community. By woodland, the tree canopy is sparse between 10% and 25% cover. The understory is dominated by low shrubs, typically dwarf birch and ericaceous shrubs. Wetlands are present, but they're not quite common. They're found along the small drainages in the area and along the fringes of lakes. And then there are occasional areas, like rocky areas like this, that are often on windswept ridges or hilltops, and these areas they're pretty sparse with vegetation, between 10 and 25% cover of any species. So here's, I'll go through a couple of examples of typical vegetation types for each of these ecoregions. The first type, and again, this is starting from the mine study area and working our way to the coast. So the first type, a white spruce woodland, and we can see sparse tree cover, and then an understory that's dominated by these low shrubs. Again, dwarf birch, blueberry, crowberry, Labrador tea. There's some lichen. The soils are quite nice, relatively thin organic layers, well stratified, and very well drained. Another common community type in the first ecoregion, the woodland area, is called dwarf ericaceous shrub tundra. This is quite extensive. The species composition in this community is very similar to the open white spruce forest, with the exception of a lack of spruce trees. So the dominant plants are ericaceous shrubs with some dwarf birch. Lichen is quite common, occasional low willows. And the soils can be quite dry and excessively drained, lots of cobbles with a very thin soil structure. Now here's the alter ego of that same vegetation type. So this is the same basic community composition, dwarf ericaceous shrub tundra, but this is this community is now occurring as a wetland type. The main difference is that there are more sedges. There's less lichen and typically more sphagnum moss. The soils are quite different, a thicker organic mat, glade colors in the soil indicating a reduced environment. This next type, wet meadows are not very common in this part of the transportation corridor. They occur along small drainages and along small water bodies, and where they exist, they tend to include a lot of areophorums or cotton grass, robust sedges, some blue joint, some equisetum. Another common feature in the woodland ecoregion are seasonal ponds. These are areas that may be flooded early in the growing season, and then they drain once the seasonal frost drops out. These areas are, because they're so sparsely vegetated, they're typically mapped as a partially vegetated or barren land cover type. Here's what a cottonwood forest looks like along the transportation corridor. These cottonwood are getting hammered pretty hard by the wind in the region. They're not very common, but we do see them occasionally along drainages. Another wetland type, a dwarf birch ericaceous shrub bog. This community is quite similar to the other dwarf ericaceous shrub types we saw a moment ago, although this type is distinct with thicker peat deposits, a greater abundance of sedges and moss. So moving on to the forested zone, this is the second ecoregion along the transportation corridor. So the forested zone is generally from Canyon Creek past Pedro Bay to the mouth of Shinkley's Creek, which is near Pyle Bay. The forested zone, in general, tree cover is more dense. We see a mix of white spruce and Kenai birch. The white spruce includes a lot of beetle-killed spruce trees. Along the mountain slopes, alder tends to be dominant, and there are the drainages are larger in size and have a more well-developed floodplain. So within the floodplain, we see willow and alder communities and wetland sedge communities. So looking at this is a typical broadleaf forest of Kenai birch, a well-drained soil with some spodic development. This is interesting. This layer, it might look like an E layer. This isn't an E layer. This is actually volcanic ash that was deposited from the last main eruption in the early 1900s. As we moved further to the coast, this layer became more and more prominent within our soil pits. Another common forest type within this central region is open white spruce birch forest. Again, very well-drained soils. Here's that ash layer again. The soil colors are, they pretty strongly suggest that this is not a reduced environment. Wetlands within the central region included more sedge moss wet meadows. All right, and now this is the third ecoregion. So this region begins near Pyle Bay and continues to the coast. The marine shrublands ecoregion is really dominated by these extensive alder thickets along mountain slopes. Drainages tend to be smaller, and valley bottoms include wetlands and wetlands with herbaceous communities and alder and willow thickets in the riparian zone. A typical photo of a closed alder thicket. Not a lot going on here. A blue joint meadow with fireweed intermixed. Blue joint was often a non-wetland community, but it did occasionally occur as a wetland type in riparian areas. This is a photo of a dwarf ericaceous shrub tundra type. We saw a photo of this same type, but it was quite different, and it shows some of the variation within a vegetation community. The sedges that you can see in the midsection of the photo suggest that this is probably the wetland version of this community type. This is the same community type, dwarf ericaceous shrub tundra, but now we're looking at the non-wetland version of it. And then along the coast, we saw salt-tolerant sedge communities. These were more extensive within Anniskin Bay and near Williamsport. Mudflats were a large proportion of the study area along Cook Inlet, sparsely vegetated. All right, I'll move into summaries of the data. So as a whole, the transportation corridor was just under 24,000 acres. Wetlands comprised approximately 8% of that area. Water bodies, including coastal areas, again, about 8%. Non-wetlands, about 84%. This column to the right is a comparison with our mapping and the National Wetlands Inventory. So you can see that whereas we mapped the area as 8% wetlands, NWI mapped it as 5% wetlands. This is pretty common, and it's likely the result that the resolution of the aerial photography that we had and the resolution of the contour data was fine enough for us to pick out small wetlands and water bodies that the NWI couldn't identify. This table shows basically the prevalence of a grouped vegetation type to either be a wetland or not. Forest types were the most common vegetation type in the transportation corridor, but there were proportionally few wetlands that were forests. Only 3% of the forest types were wetlands. Shrub types were less common and occurred as wetlands slightly more often, but shrubs were also not very likely to be wetlands. And herbaceous types, where they occurred, herbaceous communities were often wetlands. This table is just another way of slicing up wetland acreage, and it shows that it shows the percentage of all wetlands and water bodies based on those generalized cover types. So the take-home message here is that water bodies are about half of the wet area but about half of that is subtitle. Shrublands make up about a quarter of all wet areas and half of all vegetated wetlands. I mentioned earlier that we assigned HGM types to every polygon. On the left of this table is a list of all of the HGM codes. I won't go through each HGM type. These are pretty standard codes used in wetland delineations. The take-home message here is that approximately a quarter of the wetlands were mapped as slope wetlands. So these are areas that tend to discharge groundwater. Depressional wetlands were mapped, but not quite as common, only 12%, followed by riverine and flat wetlands and lacustrine wetlands. All right, so that's it for the results. I'm almost done with my presentation. And this is this last slide, I put this in just to show that we've collected additional field data since 2005. In 2010, we collected information in a corridor that's shown in orange. So the pink corridor is the area that's presented within the EBD documents. And we've since collected additional field data and produced mapping in some supplemental areas. Are there any questions?
Okay, we have one here.
Palmer Huff with EPA. Are there plans to build on your HGM classification with a functional assessment?
There are plans to work on a functional assessment. I won't go into the details of what that may look like this time.